wanted to ask you his first question, on particularly on the subject of Marx and Bentham. Go ahead, Nick. Yeah, go on.
Yeah,
maybe don't want to.
Thanks very much, Robin. That was a great talk. I think you could have made that two talks, really, but I doubt whether we'll be able to get all the questions in. So many questions. I just had one that interested me, was because I've just happened to have read, just finished Capital Volume 1, because I'm quite sort of recently keen on a student of Marx. And I noticed, I found surprising in the book, Marx's vitriolic kind of references towards Bentham. I didn't quite get it in the end. He kept talking about Bentham as though it was some kind of disease, but he was clearly referring to the guy himself. I mean, it's interesting. I just wondered why that was the case. I mean, Bentham has done a lot of important things for socialism. You know, quite a big list, you know, rights for women, freedom of expression, the welfare state, separation of church and state, et cetera, et cetera. I just wonder what your take, what Marx's motivation was, Robin.
Not too familiar with that, Nick. I'm not quite sure. I know Bentham did have the various social policies that you mentioned, you know, the separation of church and state, and was quite progressive in 19th century terms, his outlook. I don't think I could really usefully answer your question on that. But I would say that some of Bentham's ideas foreshadowed the utilitarian of the. Utilitarian, but the neoclassical economists developed some of the ideas based on Bentham's reasoning. I mean, he foreshadowed the diminishing marginal returns idea, for example, and his idea of utility was taken up by the neoclassical economists in the marginal revolution of the late 19th century. But regarding your point, I couldn't really say. It's a long time since I read Capital Volume 1. I'm sorry about that, but maybe somebody else might be able to throw in a comment.
The only thing I would say about that is Marx didn't have many good things to say about any other philosophers all his time. He tended to rip most of them to shreds, almost without exception. Unless he was complimenting others because he wanted to get in with them. But generally speaking, he contradicted most things that other philosophers had to say at that time for what it's worth. Anyway, shall we move on? Is that okay with you, comrade? We'll go to Mark, another fellow Central Branch buddy. Mark, what's your question, comrade?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Robin. That was... actually, I was expecting that from you. I mean, that tour de force, given the articles you write and everything, it was very, very helpful. I hope that if it hasn't been reduced to writing, it will be. So thank you very much for that. I have to say, I have a kind of a slightly heavy heart in asking this question. I'm a bit afraid of even asking the question. But the word mass society sort of hangs heavy on my mind, and I feel that the comments you made on the psychological motivation to work and the fact that, you know, it's evident, it's provable that we don't need the money in order for us to work for other people, etc. I mean, I don't mean, but that I think that's proved. I mean, I think what your talk, you know, demonstrates that very, very strongly. There's another aspect to the money economy, to the capitalist money economy, and that is that it serves, the money serves as a way of mediating the division of labor, both locally, nationally, internationally. So, for example, if there aren't enough doctors coming through through the system, then you have to raise the salary that doctors get paid. You know, there are various ways of actually, you know, as it were, planning the economy, but not through a Soviet style planned economy, but a capitalist style planned economy where the stimulus for work or not for working, but for particular work, particular jobs is created through the money. And strikes me that, knowing that we're not going to go back to a small community world, although probably we would love to, wouldn't there have to be in a socialist society a very highly developed administrative aspect? For example, we don't have enough doctors. You know, in capitalism, we don't have enough doctors, so we can import some from other parts of the world. We don't care if on other parts of the world they don't have doctors. There are tools, and those things need to be done over sort of many years, you know, of actually getting the flow, the pipeline of students and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not like you see rubbish outside your door, your house, and say, oh, I better clear out the rubbish. There's stuff that needs to be done way ahead of things. And if we don't do them way ahead, then we suddenly find that we've got a crisis, a lack. So you answered the objection about, can socialism work in a mass society? And I'm asking that question from the point of view, not from necessarily the point of view getting people to work, but actually how to actually organize the division of labor, you know, in effectively. Yeah.
Yeah. I could envisage something like the equivalent of socialist job centers in socialism. I mean, it's a question of supply and demand, and we got distributed, coordinated a network that can pass information on at different levels, local, regional, and globally. I don't see any technical problem arising if there's a shortage of doctors in a particular locality, how this could not be advertised and made known to the general public. I mean, we've got the technology. There are very various ways in which you could advertise, you know, on the internet, through what I might call socialist job centers, locally, whatever. There's a multiplicity methods of doing that. I mean, we would be inheriting the technology of capitalism. So why can we not put it to use in a socialist society? I don't know. I don't know if somebody else would like to comment on that, but I don't see it as a particularly pressing problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly fair to say that we're not going to be able to cure all of capitalism's ills overnight, and that it will take decades to find, you know, what form of labour or skills are required more here, there, or everywhere, and there will be a bank of workers and teachers, whether or not schools and colleges and universities will exist, there will obviously be teaching facilities dotted around far more widespread than they are nowadays in different parts of the world that can meet the demands, as you say, of whatever's needed, more densely populated areas than there are in others. But there's certainly no magic cure. It's not like waving a wand and making everything happen overnight. It will take decades, if not centuries, to sort these things out. Next we have, if you're all right, it's okay if we move on, Mark, or are you wanting to come back?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thank you for that. I was just thinking about the issue of administration, you know, because one of our, you know, views, beliefs, hopes is that the state will wither away. Well, of course, the coercive state, that's one thing, but the administering of this worldwide division of labor, you know, there's going to be parts of the world which are, you know, not favorably located, you know, for various reasons, with not many resources, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's going to have to be, you know, it's going to, you know, you mentioned the number 8 billion people, right? It's just such a huge number. I feel that it's lovely to think of that we could go to some kind of New England. I'm thinking of the United States, you know, some Puritan style village where we kind of all, you know, I think that's partly what the Marx's vision was. Of course, in the 19th century, the world was very different in terms of both population numbers, of the technology, and therefore the needs required. You know, whereas a lot of these things are going to take quite a lot of strategic planning, not even just exchanging of information, but quite a lot of planning. So I'm just thinking about it from that point of view. Mm-hmm. That's just a comment that I think the mass society argument is not only about the motivation to work, it's also about the coordination of it all, that it would actually make sense. If at the end of the day, if a surgeon will have to go to work, because if a surgeon has got five operations lined up, the surgeon won't be able to go fishing on that day. And one wonders how, you know, because in a small group of people, social disapproval is easily, you know, show, as we know how things work. So social disapproval, social respect, you can easily visualize that in a small community. But in a mass society, what tools are there going to be to ensure, for example, that doctor does turn up and doesn't just go off fishing because he has no obligation? So I have a feeling that we're going to have more need of administrative intervention than perhaps we would like, or perhaps we envisaged now would be needed. I think that aspect of the organization of mass society, I think is still for me pretty an open question. But anyway, I'll leave it there. I appreciate your comments.
Thanks both of you. We can maybe continue that side of the conversation at one of our central branch meetings, because it's an interesting one to pose. So we'll have a discussion of that amongst ourselves at one of our further meetings. It's a good one. So we better move on, folks, because our time is racing away, and we've got quite a few questions building up. Steve, Comrade Finch, you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Chairman. And thanks for your talk, Robin. Absolutely superb. Just a couple of slightly related questions. You mentioned early on in your talk that the people that were... That are looked up to now as the originator. Okay, I'm assuming you mean Smith, and I don't know whether Locke or Hume, but I just wonder if you could give us some pointers you said that there was a lot of support for the repression that was going on amongst the displaced agricultural population, for example, by these types of people. I wonder if you could give us a reference to that, please. Just that's purely for my own interests. And another question: I don't know whether this is opening a can of worms, but how does the latter part of capital, the volume standard, when you look at it in terms of the capitalist accumulation? Sorry, primitive.
Sorry.
Do you want me to repeat that? Did I drop out?
Yeah.
I do apologise. Yeah. So my second part, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get two questions. Price of one. Price of one. Two questions instead of one. How does this historical part of capital in terms of the primitive accumulation, how does that stand up in in terms of recent historic research? Oh, that's not putting you on the spot, by the way. That's it.
Yep. I'll try and there's a book I have in mind. I've forgotten the name, but I'll post it in the link section for you about the I think it's The Invention of Capitalism is the title of the book. I can't recall now, but the early stuff, the history, primitive accumulation, and so on. It's very useful on that, and also the attitude of the economists at the time, like Adam Smith, Ricardo, and so on, and their views on legislation affecting the workers, affecting land enclosures, and so on.
That's good enough. That's good enough. Thank you.
I'll research it and I'll post a link.
Smart. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to John, Comrade Cummings. What's your question, mate? You there, John? Need to unmute.
Yes. It was just a small thing about the point Nick made a while back about Marx's apparent antipathy towards Bentham. As you'll have noticed in Capital, he's quite scathing about a lot of people. He has some good words to say about factory inspectors. But I was going to say that I have not much to say about why he was so hostile to Bentham. But I think there are pretty good reasons why he would be. He might have got it slightly out of proportion, I don't know. That could be a big, wide discussion on its own. But it's a thing that Marx was prone to do, was criticise some people for what you might consider more personal reasons. I remember reading somewhere, I was trying to find it there, but I can't remember where it was. I don't think it was in Capital anywhere, any of the volumes. A statement by Marx where he said, "I smell the work of the fat Bakunin here," which is an example of something that I thought, in prissy sort of speak of today, we would say, oh, that's highly inappropriate. So, you know, Marx was just unfortunately prone to do some of those things. On the question of shortages of doctors, or, you know, that was the example given by somebody, it may be that in a socialist society, well, it will be in a socialist society, people will be truly educated for the first time. So it may well be that many people will be able to do what are considered highly skilled things today, what are considered to be routine operations by doctors in the future. And it may be that many, many people will be able to perform those things as though it were first aid. That's a thing that I think might develop as socialism develops. Obviously, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think that's a thing to consider about socialist society. The limitations we have on who can train for what are going to be virtually eliminated. So there's all sorts of possibilities open up there.
Excellent. Well said, John. Agree with everything there. Would you like to come back on that, Robin, or can we move on to the next one? Do you mind if we move on, John? Would that be okay? We'll go to Paddy, if that's all right. Go on, Paddy.
Yes, that's fine.
Thanks, John.
One or two things I was thinking. This thing about administration that I think Mark raised, I don't see any problem with that, really. I think, yeah, a socialist society would involve quite a huge amount of organisation, which would in turn involve administration. But, I mean, you know, why not? I mean, you need to administer things. You need to administer a global society. Administration is not government. You know, they're different things, aren't they? So I don't think that's an issue. And one of the things that would be administration would have to consider is the distribution of work, of labour, types of labour. It occurred to me that this idea that I think we sometimes have this rather sort of utopian idea that anyone can go and do any job they like in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. I mean, that's just not realistically so. All you've got to think about the fact that a lot of types of work that's quite skilled. Now, skilled work needs training. It needs, in some cases, quite a lot of years of training, and that involves quite a lot of sunk labour and resource costs. It takes a lot of effort and time and labour to train somebody to do a skilled job. Someone's got to do all of that, and they've got to have a place to do it as well, like a college or something like that. So you couldn't just have everybody just say signing up and saying, oh, I want to be, like you said, a neurosurgeon, Robin. Socialism would have to discriminate between those students who showed flair at it and application and ability and those ones who didn't. So that leads me to my first question, which is, would we see competitive exam systems in socialism? I mean, that sounds like anathema, and yet I can't really see how else socialism would discriminate and pick the most worthwhile students. The other side of this question is this idea of us all being multi-skilled and polytechnic. Now, I think that I've always thought that is how people generally are. That capitalism has led to a situation of super specialisation. It's in fields that are so narrow that, particularly in science, that specialists in each field really can't even communicate with people in other fields. So there's a lot of forward innovation, but not a lot of sideways innovation because of that. But what that's done in capitalism is it's driven technological innovation. Science has now become so big and so complex and so specialised, it's impossible for anyone to be a polymath anymore. I mean, the famous polymaths were from 300 or 400 years ago. It's just not possible anymore. If we don't have this super specialisation in socialism, would we not see technological innovation at the same rate? And I'm not saying even if we didn't see it at the same rate, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something that we ought to factor in. I don't know if what Robin thinks of any of that.
Go on, Robin. Do you want to reply to that? To unmute Robin.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a matter of degree, isn't it? I agree, but as I tried to indicate in the talk, that there'll be both specialists and generalists, and specialists no doubt will involve themselves in work other than the work for which they were trained. But it's, as I say, I think it's a matter of degree. I think the argument that you can do without specialists in that sense, it's not really credible for the various reasons that have been mentioned. But it's a matter of degree. I think this is the thing that I'd like to emphasize, that sure, there'll be specialists, but specialists would also do other work. They won't be the employment contract forbidding them, you know, to do other work as well. Okay, yeah. Could I just very quickly mention that I've just, regarding the previous question, I posted a link to the book that I had in mind. It's The Invention of Capitalism. And it's Michael Perelman is the author, for those of you who are interested. The Secret History of Primitive Accumulation.
I think
it's
already,
it's in the link section.
Excellent. And I think certainly as far as, you know, having specializations, there's no doubt that whether you're, you know, cleaning toilets or, you know, operating and people saving lives, you'd still have to have a fairly high degree of competency to be able to do some of these specialized things. You know, nobody could just walk into something and hope for the best. It might not be groups of people sitting in, you know, big assemblies being tested per se, but certainly there would have to be some sort of mechanism to make sure that you know, you weren't in danger of killing people by whatever your sort of not employment, whatever your work status is. Anyway, here we go with Pat. Comrade Deutz, you're next.
Right, hello, thank you, and thank you for the talk. Well, I wanted to say something about the administration, because that is an important consideration. But I think that it doesn't help, for, at least it doesn't help me, to think about billions. I think we have to think more of local and regional organisation, but obviously worldwide coordination. And today the possibilities for communications are absolutely fantastic, even if they're somewhat perverted at the moment. But we have to always make use of what we have to begin with. And there are all sorts of there are government departments that could be deprived or locked of all the financial and coercive elements, to the organisation could, to begin with, what could be used, assuming that we are thinking of something for now and not, sadly, as you know, for some time in the future. But if we break it down and think in terms of not of countries, but of regions, and if they want to go by the same names, well, that's fair enough. But with regions and local, and making things as locally as possible, except where it makes more sense not to do that. And it, surely it will be a common sense society, freed from the financial considerations, from the coercive considerations, and thinking of the best way of doing things and the most what's the word I was going to say, the most environmentally friendly. I was thinking of the economical was what I was thinking of, but economical way of doing it, but not, of course, in terms of the finances. There would still have to be considerations of the best ways of doing things, but the administration shouldn't be thought of as being a difficulty, because it will be part of the freedom of the situation, that actually looking at how to organise things and not starting from scratch, but starting from where we are and out developing out of that some, you know, even better ways of doing things. And as for the doctors, well, it should surely be a healthier society. I don't mean there won't be accidents, but there will. There may be natural disasters and, you know, I'm not suggesting that we can eliminate all illness, but if you think of all the illnesses and problems that people have that arise out of capitalism, about how things are done now, it should be a healthier society. So I think that I should just say, in defence of Marx, actually, that he is very good at acknowledging where his ideas come from and what he's using to develop. And if sometimes he's a bit scathing about some of the people. I think that's probably understandable, but I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Excellent. Good contribution, Pat. You want to say something about that, Robin? Want to speak, Robin? You want to come back on that if you're on mute? Yeah.
Sorry, I was... Nothing really to...
Let me see. So there's a few sort of exchanges going on in the speaking queue, but I was interested in, this sort of question about who'll do all the dirty work, and it reminded me there's a programme, I don't know if you have access to UK TV or catch up or anything like that on the internet, but there's quite an interesting programme on Channel 4 that I get roped into watching sometimes here, and I think it's Channel 4 or Channel 5. Anyway, it's here, and it's something like Dirty House to Clean Home or something like that, and it very often it takes you into some people's houses who have... it's maybe the sort of contrast to the right to be lazy. There are some people who genuinely just cannot seem to find the ability or the wherewithal to the hoarders, and they just can't seem to keep a clean, tidy home. And it can be anything from these old withered old grand duchesses living in castles who just can't be bothered, and they've got wild animals coming in and shitting all over the place, or it can be just one lad trying to live independently in a small flat, and the house is just covered from head. It's so unhygienic, cat shit everywhere and the likes. Anyway, the premise of the program is you've got these two lads that come in who they're the stark opposite. They just have this real kind of penchant for absolute cleanliness, and they get their sort of kicks from just the pleasure that they derive from going in and completely transforming these houses from absolute dumps to some really pristine and clean. And their only motivation is, presumably they'll be getting paid for it, but you can clearly see that their passion is the reward that they get from transforming the house to something nice and clean from something otherwise filthy. Regardless of how much they do or don't get paid for it, they would do it anyway. And it just really backs up what you were saying about, some people get pleasure from things that others don't, and there's bound to be a place for everyone to find their niche and to be able to contribute in a way that pleases them and keeps society ticking over in a fairly organised and healthy way. So that's one of those examples of the whole cleanliness question, who'll do the dirty work now? Here we go with. So on that happened, right, we've got Steve now. Steve, Comrade Finch, you've got another question. Go on.
Nice. It's just a very rapid contribution. We've mentioned many, many times tonight the idea of these the surgeons as being something that's looked up to in society, and of course they're very valuable. But if you go back to the through the history of medicine, when there's this guy called Galen who was around in Roman society, and he was very influential right up to the Middle Ages until you got the Renaissance. This was the reference for medicine. He wouldn't touch anybody. He used to have people doing the surgery for him. So he would do these demonstrations, and he would never touch the patient. He'd get somebody else to amputate the leg or whatever it was. He wouldn't touch them. He'd be talking to people. So it's not always been the case that surgery has been this socially respectable activity. And he's exactly the same. So, I mean, obviously, the point is that respect for given types of activity are socially determined, and they'll be socially determined in a free society as well as within capitalism, as we're already seeing about these dear people who work in keeping the health service going. So I didn't mean that as sarcastic, but they've suddenly become the cleaners, the bin men, etc. Lorry drivers have suddenly become heroes, and they'll be heroes in a socialist society as well. Simple as that. Thank you.
Well said, Steve. Superbly put. Okay, comrades. Well, listen, I'm aware of the time, and getting back to what I said earlier on about Spain and Robin being too ahead of hours ahead of us. You know, time's rooting it on. I'm sure he must be tired after that outstanding presentation. It really was terrific. I'm wondering if, in the absence of any further questions, if there's any last minute ones.
About administration, it's long been, the socialist case that there would be, administrative bodies. We're not envisaging some, global monolithic entity, which would be inefficient anyway. As I think it was Pattett says, that these would be organised on a local basis to, among other things, match supply to demand. There could be some global apparatus, but there'd be all these regional bodies as well. On the subject of, to use a modern expression, multitasking, you've had people throughout history, albeit from privileged backgrounds, who could seem to turn their hand to very divergent fields. A guy who comes to mind, for instance, is Edwin Hubble. Now, he was a lawyer, that was his profession. Then, he studied astronomy, he made this great contribution, he discovered that the universe was expanding and so on. Now, many people, of course, they don't have the benefit of such a favourable upbringing, access to such educational tools. But, that would change in a socialist society. So I think there'd be an awful lot more multitasking as a result of this. People, would enjoy a more comprehensive education. I'd just like to pick up on something Steve said about Roman society. Yeah, there were some people, surprisingly, who weren't held in very high esteem. For example, teachers. I believe that teachers were slaves. So they were, in the lower rungs, of the Roman social strata. Anyway, just like to thank you all for your contributions. Thoroughly enjoyed your talk, hey, Robin. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Norman. And if unless anyone else is getting they want to say, I'll maybe take the opportunity to thank Robin and ask him to maybe wind up. And thanks also to everyone else that came along tonight. We've got Warwick down under along with Moggy and as well as Mark over in Poland. So yeah, another sterling turnout tonight. Thank you all very much for coming. If I can just hand over to you, Robin, now is there anything you'd like to say to wind up this evening, if that's okay?
No, not really. Nothing really springs to mind, but thanks for all your contributions. It's something we need to think about. I'm just wondering whether something more directly to the related to the human nature argument could be produced in amongst our pamphlet stock. I know we've got the pamphlet on are genes a barrier to certain, but something more directly relevant to human nature. I don't know what people think about that, but it might be a useful addition, because this argument about human nature crops up again and again. So I'll just leave you with that thought.
It's maybe one for the Robin Cox mind, a nature or nurture versus nature booklet. Who knows? There could be a collaboration in there somewhere, no doubt. It's certainly one to be explored. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in the meantime, Robin, everyone, if it's okay with you guys, we are now on 10 to 10, and I'm sure we've got a lot going on in our minds after that wonderful discussion and presentation tonight. So I'm sorry if you never get the chance to ask any questions, but maybe next time, and I dare say, this subject will undoubtedly crop up again. If you never get a chance tonight, then hopefully next time. Okay, comrades, we'll call it a night at that. Oh, wait a minute, we've got someone just before everyone dashes off, a contribution from Warwick saying, many thanks, very interesting, lovely. Thank you, Warwick. Well done. Okay, comrades, good night to you all. Until the next time.
Good night.